is the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, in the lives of adolescents, teenagers today, it's hard to overestimate the role of music. As a matter of fact, you look at them in the mall, you look at them even in school or wherever, you're going to see pockets with iPods, and you're going to see those white lines coming out of the ears of an awful lot of kids. Music is not new to teenagers. Just think back to your own adolescence, and you'll realize that music has always been important. It's been important as a means of developing peer identities, of developing a peer culture. It's also, of course, a way of sending a message. Just think of the music of the 60s. And just think of, by the way, how many baby boomers still think that that was the great music. What was the message of that music? Well, we can look back at it now and we can see that that music was not only about tone and structure and all the musical components. It was about a message. Every single piece of music, every single piece, whether instrumental or vocal, comes with a message. For teenagers today, they're really faced by an array of musical choices that can be far more toxic than parents may be aware of. As a matter of fact, some of the worst, most insidious, most misogynist, that is, injurious to women, most anti-human, most evil, most promiscuous and debauched messages are that which is celebrated in much music today. We're going to talk today about how parents should think about the music of their children. What you're going to be hearing is an address I gave in a local church trying to help parents to understand their responsibility. I'm a parent of a teenager, two of them now, so I should say our responsibility in guarding the hearts and minds and ears of our children when it comes to their engagement with music. Let's face it, the music's going to get through, but it's our responsibility to make sure it's the right music and that we help our kids to develop discernment in wanting to hear the right music, and in appreciating the right music. Stay tuned. I think you'll find this very interesting. To understand that our teenagers, our young people, young adults, and especially children, they are in a mass culture. Here is this mass culture, and it surrounds us with all kinds of images and messages. It comes in so many different ways, from radio and the iPod to Hollywood and television and books and advertising, and we literally can't get away from it. We're not away from it even as we are in here tonight, because the mass culture also has to do with such things as clothing and styles and fashion and other things that influence most of us wherever we are at any given time. And we are increasingly wired. That is the other phenomenon. If you go back to when I was a preschooler in the early 1960s, and you imagine the average American suburban home, and that home would likely be a radio. And there might even be more than one radio, because the transistor revolution of the late 1950s and the early 1960s allowed the mass production of the transistor radio and other things. So in the home there was a multiplicity of these things, because the cost unit of providing a radio and producing it was dropping precipitously. So it was there. Television was a relatively new medium, only about 15 years old in terms of mass distribution in the early 1960s. And about half of all American homes had a television, and those that had a television had one. By and large, it was the television. And that's when America developed its new family altar. Not too long ago, an archaeologist wrote an article about what would happen if we were to come back to America after it was a ruin and after the civilization had disappeared, and it was much like going to Nineveh or to ancient Babylon today. If they were to excavate an American home, would believe that the television or the entertainment center was the family altar. It's at the center of the room. It was obviously the center of attention. Around this box are arrayed all of the chairs and the furniture, soft and plush furniture for long endurance in front of the altar. And you can just see, and some people would even think that they fed the altar, because there would be like a ruins of a potted plant or something on top of it. And it would appear that, or perhaps there was a bowl of snacks in front, and they would have thought that we would feed this thing as some future civilization would try to figure us out. But even though that is something of a parody, it has the ring of truth in it, because when we think about our homes, let's face it, they are increasingly becoming wired media entertainment centers. We've gone from a radio or two, plus a television, and one phone. And that phone was generally, literally one. When I was growing up, the phone was between
the kitchen and the bathroom hanging on the wall. And it was a party line. And you had to wait for someone to get off. And if it was the two little old ladies down the street, you were sunk. It was their only contact with humanity. And that's just the way it worked. And the party line is now something my children cannot possibly understand. I don't even want to add up all the phones to which we have access. How many lines come into a home? And generally, it's just still one landline. But think of all the cell lines. Think of all the different means of communication. And then, of course, the television has now expanded to where many homes have two, three, four, or more televisions. The televisions have grown in complexity to where before they were the black and white set. They had to warm up. We talked about even being able to smell the tubes warming up. Now, there's a generational marker right there. We talked about the terror of trying to turn it off when it wouldn't go off. And what that was like as the tubes had to slowly cool down. But now you have large sets. You're talking about 48, 60-inch sets that are increasingly sold as, again, the main altar in the home, with smaller altars distributed throughout the house. Now, there are many things I want to say about this, but one thing I want to say, because I want to be very specific, in deliberative and deliberate discernment, one principle is we should narrow the access to our children's lives. We need to narrow the access with the technology even before we narrow the access with the content. I mean, frankly, if you've got a teenager with a television in his room, what you are doing is encouraging him to be separate from the family and to be watching unsupervised television. If you connect that to a cable system, as most televisions increasingly are, you just give him options he shouldn't have. And so you need to narrow what we could call the bandwidth of the mass culture coming in to your child's life. And that will not be popular. And here again, you can't separate the cell phone from mass culture. That was true even before when what you did with the cell phone was talk. But it's a lot more true now that the cell phone has become a camera, an MP3 player, and a video player in many cases, in which the camera is now like a mini portable altar. And if you're wearing a pair of cargo pants, which is probably not true of many in here tonight, but if you are wearing a pair of cargo pants, you can have the iPod in one pocket and the cell phone in the other pocket. You can have one pocket in which you can distribute your expensive custom-made headphones. You can be wearing your hoodie with the speakers already built in so that no one can actually tell you're listening anyway. And at that point, you have a walking entertainment system with a self-contained adolescent. You have no idea what she's hearing, or with the cargo pants, he. You've got no idea what's being broadcast into their brains by message and medium. And that's the point. So knowing what we're up against is a matter of not only volume and content, it's a matter of time. Just imagine how much time the average adolescent spends with mass media. Wakes up in the morning, there's probably not even silence in the bathroom. There's music going while the kid's getting ready in the morning. There is something that will make noise in the bedroom. They're probably awakened by something that made noise and playing music and all the rest. They're probably in a vehicle. If they're not riding a school bus going to school, they're hearing this. And increasingly, they're hearing it at school, too. And, you know, this is not just a phenomenon that's happening in schools. It's happening in homes. In a scary amount of homes, teenagers are just allowed to completely immerse themselves into this. And I said, we started at school. And at school, they're also surrounded by peers who are the reinforcers of the mass culture decisions they make. They are the introducers into new options in mass culture, and they are the affirmation of the kinds of trends that that the peer orientation of adolescence is going to grab a hold of. And then they come home, and an increasing number of kids, an increasingly large percentage of both children and adolescents come home to empty homes. And as latchkey kids, they are entertained by the electronics. They have an absolute immersion in this throughout much of the day. And then in the evening, it just gets worse. And then when they have the time and opportunity, they go to see a movie. And then they're on their friends. They're on the chat rooms on the internet. They're on the cell phone. And they are completely immersed in this culture with a vocabulary and a set of symbols and a mass amount of content that parents simply don't know about. So we're talking about narrowing the bandwidth in terms of deliberate discernment. One of the first things we have to do is understand that if we allow our children to be completely immersed in this without boundaries and controls, we can't possibly even know the content of which they are consumers and the messages of which they are recipients. We've got to have control over this. That means limiting the cell phone. That means putting boundaries around television, cable, and that means boundaries of time and boundaries of choices. And these are not easy things, because their peers are probably not going to be suffering the same parental oppression. And so they will likely find themselves or think themselves to be horribly oppressed and repressed and abused by the fact that they're having their choices limited, and there are boundaries that must be honored as the bandwidth is narrowed.
As I say, the beat goes on, the music's out there, and our kids are listening to it. That's a parent's concern. That's what we're talking about. Stay tuned.
I want to speak, because time is of the essence, just about several specific areas of which we need to be aware. And the first is television. I want to point out something about television that is often beyond our immediate concern. What we immediately think about is what pictures are on the screen and what kind of words are being spoken and what kind of message is overt. But let's remember that television is also a covert communication device. And so there is much being communicated that is beyond what you see on the screen or think you're seeing. Now, I'm not talking about some kind of subliminal seduction here. There are all kinds of interesting things about that. I'm talking about that which is covert. It is less seen and often not noticed. For instance, when the movie E.T. was made, and we're talking here in the 80s, we're talking here 20 years ago, when the movie E.T. was made, a decision was made by the producer and the director of that movie to allow a commercial product to be featured. That commercial product was new, and it was relatively unknown in the United States of America, and most of you already know it's Reese's Pieces. Reese's Pieces went from being an unknown commodity to being a staple of the culture because E.T. had a taste for Reese's Pieces. Instantly, Hollywood learned a lesson, and that is that what is called product placement is very effective. And so producers, marketers now, work very hard to get their products identified in both television and the cinema. So you're talking about logos worn on clothes, you're talking about specific kinds of electronic gadgets that people are using and high-tech devices, you're talking about food, you're talking about drinks, you're talking about beer, you're talking about all kinds of things. These marketers want these things to be focused on. They want them to be noticed. And of course, you're also talking about automobiles and other things, brand names. Now, if they consider this so important that they will have entire staff divisions working on product placement, then you had better be concerned about it, because something is being communicated beyond the storyline and the plot and what you are aware of seeing on television. Again, just in the last few days, a major study has been released indicating that teenagers think that adults drink alcohol more than they actually do. This is a very interesting study. It's just come out. You can find it very easily on the Internet. A lot of news stories about it. And it originated from Great Britain, but it has to do with the same media our kids are watching as well. And it comes out of the fact that kids watching television have the impression that people drink even more alcohol than they do. Now, a couple of things that go on there. Number one, it looks normal. And number two, the kids think that people can actually drink that much without suffering horrible health disasters and worse. Now, the message I'm communicating to my children is total abstinence from alcohol, period. Not a matter of safe drinking, it's a matter of not drinking in an informed and convictional choice. But you know, there are a lot of parents out there who aren't clear about that with their kids. And again, what they're being told is this is normal. And they're being told it's normal largely in very subversive ways. And it's interesting that the same authorities who have made it very difficult to advertise overtly specific alcoholic drinks, beverages, and products are evidently blind to the fact that it's still in the product placement. It's still out there. And even if you can't see the brand name so much, the drinking itself is honored, valued, and celebrated in the mass media. And that's just drinking. It has to do with other things, and the most important other thing it has to deal with is sexuality. Because television itself, in terms of its dramas, sitcoms, and most overtly now its advertising, is more and more overt, not just covert, but overt in terms of the sexual messages that are communicated. And this has to do also with fashion. You know, the death of modesty in the mass media means that you just almost can't turn on the television safely. I was watching the, and some of you will laugh at this, I was watching the NCAA college football final game, the Rose Bowl. And I watched the final 8 minutes of it. And my wife, who thinks that's absolutely pathetic, nonetheless understands that that's when I get interested. And this one really was interesting, wasn't it? But you know what? I was with a group of pastors, and the reason we hadn't seen the rest of the game is because we had a very important meeting as we were gathered together. We were meeting in our home, and there were six of us. And as the game was on, one of the concerns was turning off the ads. You know, who's got the remote control to turn off the ads? Why? Because you just brace yourself for what's coming on during a major sporting event. Now, why do you think that's so? Those advertisers are not paying millions and millions of dollars because they think this isn't going to be effective. They know how to get the male attention. Without being graphic, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Just remember that adolescent males are extremely susceptible to having sexual images impressed upon them through the mass media that will affect their sexual profiles and their erotic expectations for the rest of their lives. Especially between the ages of 12 and 14, young boys are extremely susceptible to being imprinted with sexual messages of which they are not even fully aware. As they get older, they get more aware. But at a certain stage of early adolescence, they're much less aware of this. And so there are ideas in their minds, and there are images and pictures in their minds that are tied to sexual interest and all the rest. And all they had to do was watch a football game with their dad. And there it is. And then, of course, I mentioned also that girls are particularly susceptible in adolescence to the development of romantic yearnings and understandings. And what message they get from the mass media is largely that sex, and if not overtly sexual acts, then at least sexualization and immodest dress and immodest behavior is the way to gain the kind of romantic interest they want from young males. And Hollywood television in particular, as well as the movies, are very keen to communicate that. Now, one of the problems with television that you might think of that is somewhat different than the movies to which we will turn next is that there really is no rating system, and the family hour is a thing of the past, and so you can't count on any safe message whatsoever. There's no safe hour. There's no safe channel. Not totally. You know, for instance, just to talk about messages, you might think that a kid's channel will be safe. You can't count on that anymore. Not at all. Let me just give you one example, and this has nothing to do with sex or drugs or alcohol. It has to do with parental authority. What do you do with the Berenstain Bears cartoons? The dad is a doofus. Every single storyline of the Berenstain Bears has to do with somebody revealing to dad how stupid he is. Usually the mom. But generally, even the kids are smarter. And so here you have, there's no sex, you know. Papa Bear's not smoking a cigarette, you know, not, you know, watching pornography on the television. He's not drinking a beer, but he's a doofus. What you have here is the father's authority completely undermined. The father becomes the fall guy. And that's not unique to the Berenstain Bears. It's found in other children's narratives as well. Also, it's the staple of sitcoms. In fact, the worldview of the sitcom is that kids are wise and parents are stupid. And eventually, the turning point in the episode comes when the parents catch on to how wise the kids are and smarten up. That's by and large the formula for television.
Well, as I say, the beat goes on. The music's out there, and our kids are listening to it. That's a parent's concern. That's what we're talking about. Stay tuned.
Something else is happening that you often don't notice, however, and that is what happens to the attention span of kids with television. I say of kids because we don't admit it could affect us as well. It, of course, does. Television is cut up into approximately 8-minute units separated by commercials. If you want to have a successful television program, you have to be able to gain the attention of people and hold them for those 8-minute segments and make sure they come back after the commercials for the next 8-minute segment. And what you have to do is get people hooked. But you also know that somebody could be working in the kitchen watching this part of it, and somebody could be coming in from outside and watching this part of it. So you actually have to cut all those segments into standalone pieces so that someone would find it interesting enough to watch, even if only for 8 minutes. Now, life is just not like that. And so one of the problems is that our imagination, and this is especially true of the young, the imagination becomes corrupted by the idea that life is lived in these incredibly intense segments with approximately 50 to 70 scene shifts per minute on primetime television, so that everyone's always staring intently into someone else's eyes, communicating deeply profound or incredibly humorous things every 8 minutes. No wonder we as parents look absolutely boring. We can't deliver. We have no laugh track when we talk. And so we look absolutely bland and boring. And the poor preacher who has to get up and preach, he's got a message to communicate that is not cut up into neat little 8-minute segments with punchline and laugh track and all the rest. Have you ever noticed how kids just zone out after about 8 minutes? The imprinting of the television medium is simply huge, and that's something we have to think about, because it really does change the way humans think. It also flattens the imagination, because you don't have to imagine anything. The imagination just becomes a matter of being dormant while the story is told for you and the pictures are already provided for you, and it's all right there. It's qualitatively different than the experience of reading a book. Because in reading a book, the mind is required to create its own pictures. The mind is required to imagine what this voice might sound like and how this character might appear and reveal himself or herself and speak. You don't have that imagination in television, and so what we have is a lot of kids who can't read, or when they read, they don't get it. And not only do they not get it when they read, they don't get it in a lot of conversation. Let me invite you into the conversation of a couple of middle adolescent males. How many words are spoken? First of all, they're males, so cut the total number of words way down. Okay, ladies, this is a different world. And your husband's not far from this part, okay? Way down. Number of words. But these kids don't even have to speak to each other with a lot of words anymore. It can be grunts. And expressions from mass media that simply explain everything. And so it's no wonder that they sound like aliens from another planet while they're talking. It's no wonder you sound like aliens from another planet to them. And television is a big part of that. Let's move to movies for just a moment, and we'll come back in the question and answer time to specific concerns. The movies were once a safer place than they are now by far. From the late 1930s up until about 1967, Hollywood movie studios were bound to what were known as the program code or the Hays Code. These were regulations to which Hollywood was accountable, having to do with what could and could not appear on the screen. And it's pretty technical stuff. I mean, exactly how many inches of this in terms of fashions and how close to that and all that. It was all there. Who can do what? Who can kiss? Now it's a completely different thing and all the rules are off. In about 1967, the production code was done away, and in 1968, the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA, developed the ratings code as we know it now. And it was originally separated into G and PG and R and X. And so you had G, which is family entertainment, PG, which was supposedly for adolescents, R, which was for adults with explicit sexuality, and X, which was just explicit pornography. And you remember they used to emphasize X by putting XXX. You get the attention. You'd see it in along the interstates and other places where that kind of stuff would be sold. Well, several things have happened since the development of the rating system, and let's just say, first of all, it's completely broken and you can't trust it at all, period. Please, just understand that. If after we talk about bandwidth and the points I wanted to make about television, if there's one thing you get out of the movies, it's this: you can't trust the rating system at all. Because, number one, it isn't even what it was supposed to be. Now you have new ratings, such as PG-13, where PG was supposed to be already 13 and above, and now you put PG-13, you have a phenomenon known as ratings creep. Do we really think that we can trust the cinemas? Even if the rating system were to work as it was intended to work, do we really think they're going to police it so that you don't have 14-year-olds going into R-rated movies and all the rest? I don't think we would ever believe we could count on that. But when you preface that equation with the brokenness of the system in the first place and ratings creep and the way that all this is constantly negotiated, you have a real mess.
Well, as I say, the beat goes on, the music's out there, and our kids are listening to it. That's a parent's concern. That's what we're talking about. Stay tuned.
Movie producers work hard at getting the rating they want. The rating they want is on the edge between PG-13 and R. That's where most of these decisions are made by the MPAA and by the movie industry. They want to get it as close to R as possible because what they want for mass distribution of movies, big sales at the box office, is adults and teenagers both watching the movie. And so as they try in their own creative way to come up with that, they're on the edge between PG-13 and R. But the way they often negotiate this is to put together the movie and then find out what the rating would be as it is cut and then make some intermediary adjustments, some very often small adjustments in order to negotiate the PG-13 from the R. The other thing is that it's not just sex that is the concern and language of the rating system, but also violence. Now, many of us would say, well, that's a really good thing. And it is, when you consider some of the violence that can be found in movies. But let me just give you an example of a movie that indicates how broken this system is. Let's take the movie The Patriot, starring Mel Gibson as the father of a family during the Revolutionary War. I won't ask you how many saw it, but it was an R-rated movie. It was also, I believe, one of the finest movies made in the last decade or so. Why was it an R-rated movie? There wasn't a bit of sex in it. There was no bad language in it. But what was in it? A 12-year-old and a 13-year-old boy shooting a gun at the British. That alone gained that movie its R rating. Now, I'm not suggesting that you should go see R-rated movies. I am suggesting that The Patriot was a very fine movie with a very wholesome message. But it was rated R. Well, then think about the vast number of movies rated PG and PG-13 that are rancid, pornographic, have no redeeming message whatsoever, are neither patriotic nor wholesome in any way. So you can have, not to be graphic here, but just so you'll know what we're talking about, you can have 12 and 13-year-olds doing things not shooting guns that you wouldn't want them to do on a PG or a PG-13 movie using bad language, bratty behavior, very much subversive of parental authority, including all kinds of things that we could identify line by line, but the Patriots are, and those movies are not. They're PG-13 or something else. The MPAA film rating system is incredibly political, and so those of you who think you can trust it, just please hear me, you can't. You can't trust it. You're going to have to find a way to actually control the content your kids are seeing by finding out what these movies are all about. I mentioned a couple of ways you can do that. There are a couple of internet websites that are extremely valuable in this regard. One is screenit.com, screenit.com. And that one is a subscription service for most of the content. You'll have to pay a subscription fee And then you will find out more than you ever wanted to know about any major release out of Hollywood. It will give you line by line every bad word and how many times it's used, how many times a parent was disrespected, how many times who did what with whom, under what sexual circumstance. And so brace yourselves. But if you're actually considering whether your child should see this movie or not, you need to find out what is in it. The other site I would suggest is PluggedIn.com, which is owned by Focus on the Family and is produced by Focus, and there is no charge for that content. It does not include as many movies as ScreenIt.com, but it will cover all the major movies you're likely to hear discussed in the community. And then I would also suggest to you that the movie reviews in World Magazine, W-O-R-L-D Magazine, also available online, are very helpful and can give you a lot of insight into what's actually happening. All right, we could talk a lot about the movies, but I want to talk about music for just a moment. Because the lives of our adolescents are lived to a soundtrack. And I don't just mean the soundtrack to a movie, I mean the soundtrack, which is the background noise of their lives. And lest we feel ourselves morally superior, those of us who are older, let's just admit we couldn't have done this if we wanted to. I desperately wanted a stereo when I was 13 or 14 years old, and that's what it was called, a stereo. And my parents were not keen on me having a stereo, even though they would have absolute control over the music I would listen on it. They would have absolute control. But they eventually allowed me to possess this stereo, and it was the altar of my bedroom. And I had these weird black discs that I had to put on this thing that went around in circles, and I would put this needle on it, and it would scratch and scratch and scratch, and eventually noise would come out, and if I could get away with it, a lot of noise would come out. And yet, you know, I didn't get to take that with me. When I went to school, I could not put that in my pocket. I couldn't even put one record in my pocket. And if I went in my car, I couldn't have that either. I had a radio. And I eventually got what was the most up-to-date and promised to be forever the medium of the future, the 8-track. Do you remember what used to happen with the 8-track? It would move in the middle of songs. I mean, you think about a stupid medium. That had to be it. You remember how much storage you needed to have for 8-tracks? I mean, my sister used to have these drawers that would... She had it all organized. I quickly caught on to the cassette. It was smaller. It didn't jump around. You didn't have to wait for the thing to shift tracks. And you could stick it in the car. So I was uptown. Had the cassette tape. What could be better than that? Well, this is an iPod. For those of you who haven't seen it, you've heard of them. These strange devices. This particular iPod is a 60 gigabyte video iPod. This is the one that I use. I have it with me, like most adolescents, all the time. It's never far from me. I have 6,700 songs on this. I have this with me on an airplane. I can put this on. Let me tell you, this is the best crying baby defeater ever invented by the human race. At 33,000 feet, this is sanity. I can have this wherever I go, and the car I just got a few weeks ago even allows me to plug this directly into the sound system where I don't have to worry about what anyone else wants me to hear. I can hear what I want to hear. But just look how small this thing is. It's tiny. And there is more music on this, there is more entertainment on this than a room during the time of my adolescence could have contained. And not only that, the cost has gone down so dramatically in terms of real dollars that adolescents can now afford so much more of this.
Well, as I say, the beat goes on, the music's out there, and our kids are listening to it. That's a parent's concern. That's what we're talking about. Stay tuned.
So what are they listening to? What is going into the ear? Well, number one, the music is increasingly violent and vile, just to put it bluntly, because many of the most popular of the rock stars today, they're not quite so committed to the drug culture as was popular in the 70s and in the early 80s because of political pressure, But in terms of sexuality and in terms of anti-human messages, especially messages against women, not to mention the kind of language and the other things that are happening, but kids are even developing a situation in which they live life by the beat of the music. Now, by the way, I said something earlier about what I would cover during the movies, and I forgot, and that is the soundtrack. When I was out in California, I got to talk to some of the people in the movie industry in Hollywood. And one of the things that one of the producers said to me is, he said, I can make anyone cry. The music reaches our hearts in a way we don't even recognize. The Nazis understood this. Every major political movement has understood this. Every great revolution has had its music. And the adolescent revolution of our time has its own music. The drug culture of the 70s had its music. You can just go down the list. And this music is powerful in the way that it can change the disposition of the heart. The right music played at the right time can make you happy. The right music played at the right time can make you sad. You can tell the difference between a funeral dirge and a march, but you can also tell the difference between music that is overtly sensual and intended to create an erotic arousal and that which is not. One of the realities that you may as parents be discovering is that you sometimes hear language from your kids and you wonder, where is that coming from? You know, you know where they are during the day. You know who their friends are. And you wonder, where does that language come from? Well, oftentimes it's imprinted, planted, seeded in the mind by music. But the main thing I want to talk about and want to convey is that deliberate discernment means dealing with the bandwidth, narrowing the technology. And so in these closing minutes, let me just say the first thing you need to do is eliminate some technological access. I would not believe you should at any point have a television in your adolescent's bedroom. You've got to narrow the technology when it comes to cell phones. Unrestricted cell phone use is not just about using up minutes of time chatting. It's about instant messaging, and it's about sending photographs and music and electronic files and all the rest. So narrow the bandwidth, and we can talk about many ways that can be done, but also narrow the content. Set the boundaries of content, and that means that you can't just say, here's a rule, you can see this but not that category. It means you're going to have to get within the categories and actually find out what's going on.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.